I'm Tom McDonald, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Dave Heller is off this evening. Federal investigators have sought documents from Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney's last campaign as part of a probe into powerful labor leader John Dougherty. The FBI has already searched the home and office of the leader of the Electricians Union, as well as City Councilman Bobby Heenan and other associates. Now political advisor Jesse Bradley confirms to Dave Davies the Fed sought documents from Jim Kenney's 2015 mayoral campaign. Bradley is not saying what kind of documents were sought, but says the campaign is complying. Mayor Kenney's spokeswoman Lauren Hitt says the request was made of the campaign and not Kenney personally, adding that the mayor has not been interviewed by authorities and has not retained an attorney and has no reason to think he suspected of wrongdoing. A court has ordered the school district of Lancaster to transfer a group of students from a magnet school to the local high school where there's more support for learning English. Lancaster's been resettling refugees for decades. But in recent years, caseworkers noticed older teens were sent to Phoenix Academy. A private company runs an accelerated credit program at Phoenix for students at risk for dropping out or aging out before graduating. Six student refugees filed a federal lawsuit in July, alleging the practice amounted to denying them equal access to education. Their attorney says the clients have lived lives of unimaginable hardship, and they're so overdue for a break that we're just thrilled they finally received one. The district says it will comply with the order. Other issues raised in the lawsuit remain unresolved and will go before a different judge if the two sides can't work them out independently. The case is similar to recent ones in New York and Florida, although it's the first to go to trial. Lancaster resettles between 500 and 700 refugees annually, a high number for a city of 60,000 people. Vice President Joe Biden was in Wilmington, Delaware this afternoon to announce a $2.45 billion loan to Amtrak. Biden, who famously commuted daily on Amtrak to Washington when he was a U.S. senator, says the money will help the passenger railroad buy 28 new trains for its Acela service on the Northeast Corridor line. All the extra trains will expand high-speed service on that line by 40%. Anthony Koshaw of Amtrak's board of directors expects a performance boost to set a precedent.
And with that, we will bring together a train system that will clearly be an example for the entire country to build and develop a national network of intercity trains that connect city pairs throughout the United States that create the kind of mobility that Americans are looking for.
The money will also pay for track upgrades between Washington and Baltimore. Each week, Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll, joins NewsWorks Tonight's Dave Heller to talk numbers on how Americans feel about current events and personalities. On this week's edition of What Are We Thinking, the two discuss a poll on how the public views various job sectors. And if you work in the service industry, there's some good news.
This is an annual look-see that Gallup conducts.
That's right. We simply list for Americans about 25 business and industry sectors. And by the way, we include the federal government in there and ask for each one. When you hear about this industry, do you have a positive or negative impression? It may seem like strange bedfellows, but at the very top of the list, the pinnacle, as it were, of that list of 25 sectors is the restaurant industry. 66% positive image, only 7% negative. And the computer industry, 66% positive, 13% negative. Don't ask me exactly why those two do so well, but as you say, if you're listening right now and work in either of those industries, computers or restaurant, congratulations. Americans have a very positive view of your industry.
And so are those in the computer industry and restaurant industry typically at the top of the list?
They have generally been up near the top. The other ones that have been near the top historically are related to food as well as the restaurant industry. The grocery industry, farming and agriculture, for all those farmers listening, people think very positively about you. The internet industry has also been near the top. You say, is there a difference between computer and internet? Well, internet's actually down a little this year, but it's fairly near the top as well. Other ones, industry sectors that do pretty well in the eyes of Americans are accounting and the travel industry.
Frank, you've already tipped your hand. You said that the federal government is included on the list. Are they bringing up the rear?
They do, dead last. Almost every year that we put them in the list, the federal government has been last. 28%, who are these 28%, you might ask, have a favorable impression when we say federal government. But 55%, the highest of any industry sector on that negative side, say, yuck, when they hear the words federal government. And that's dead last on the list.
Who's also near the bottom?
This is very interesting, particularly for those listening in New Jersey, because the pharmaceutical industry, of course, is a big part of what New Jersey is proud of. A lot of pharmaceutical companies in New Jersey, and of course in Pennsylvania as well. But pharmaceuticals simply don't do well. 28% positive, 51% negative. And no matter how much good drugs do us as patients, pharmaceuticals simply have a negative image in the eyes of the average American. Just above, I should say, the healthcare industry in general. It's also very negative.
Frank, looking at the calendar, we are exactly 1 month out from the first presidential debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. I'm sure those tuning in are expecting fireworks. A big gulf between the two candidates is the topic of immigration, though there are some signs that Trump may be moderating his stance. And if so, how would that resonate with the public?
Trump would do well to moderate his stance, because what we find from the public is that they don't agree with his stances. Now, I can give you some examples. Massive deportations, two-thirds of Americans are against that. Building a wall between the U.S. and Mexico, 66% of Americans are opposed to that. And 84% of Americans like some kind of pathway for citizenship for people living in this country illegally. Also, overall, the average American is okay with immigration in general like it is now, or actually want it increased.
Though we could talk about this in terms of political calculus, presumably Trump's core had been hearing his message and stance and agreed with it heartily. Might he be risk losing them if he softens his stance?
That's an excellent point, and I'm sure he's thinking about that very carefully. And you're absolutely right, Dave. You know, he came to prominence first off by talking about banning Muslims from coming into the country and talking about the wall. So it is kind of what brought him to where he is now. But as I mentioned, I'm looking at this from the average American's perspective. When you put all Americans together, the data are fairly strong in opposition to Trump's policies. So when he's looking to win in November, he's going to have to move beyond his core. So I would suggest that the data indicate if he does soften on some of these policies, it probably would be a good strategy.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight.
Still ahead, a play with a vulgar title is an unexpected frontrunner for Philadelphia's upcoming theater season.
I wrote this play going, I don't think anyone's going to come see it. And I'm not sure any theater will ever produce it.
That's coming up as Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Tom McDonald, in for Dave Heller. Philadelphia has 48 zip codes, and every zip code tells a story. This year, WHYY is collaborating with AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, on the Every Zip Philadelphia project to find out what the stories are where you work, live, and play. Port Richmond is a huge neighborhood. A lot of Philadelphians know it for its Polish delis and restaurants. But many other groups have called zip code 19134 home throughout its history. Jesse Korkunis has the story of a little-known pocket community nestled near Aramingo and Lehigh Avenues with a name that sounds out of place in 2016.
And you can make a left here.
That's where my grandmother lived, across the street. My grandmother and my uncles and my aunt. And I live right here.
The first time I met Diane Precht, I did a double take when she told me where she grew up in Philadelphia.
I'm from Port Richmond, a little teeny pocket, and it's called Jewtown, and it was all black folks.
Philly Gentiles began calling the area Jewtown in the late 1800s, some feel out of resentment to the influx of Jewish immigrants. But Alan Myers, a historian and author of several books on Jewish communities here in Philadelphia, says the Jewish people themselves began identifying with the name. The history of the neighborhood is unknown to many current residents, and even though some may find it offensive, the name Jewtown has stuck, similar to other Philly areas like Germantown.
I enjoyed researching this Lithuanian community that came to Philadelphia in the 1870s because of persecution in their home country. They refused to be influenced by the German Jewish community, which was a majority community here in Philadelphia, and they remained isolated as a pocket community for those 90 years.
They settled in, built businesses and factories, and these businesses later attracted black workers.
We're coming up to Tulip Street now, and we're going to make a left on Tulip Street.
And this factory here is still operating. It's been operating since I was a kid. This is where the old synagogue was, and it's Disney's trip.
By the third generation, industry began shifting overseas, and Jewish families started to leave the neighborhood.
The end of the Industrial Revolution came and went through this community with factories opening and closing, most of them closing in the late 1970s, early 1980s. There was no more reason to live here.
As the Jews moved out, the black workers moved in.
When I moved here, I was 7 years old, and it was culture shock for me.
That's Bill Cheney. He arrived in 1957.
To move from the heart of North Philly, 21st and Diamond, which I looked at as being like Africa, and then moving here, and Jewtown was like South Africa. There were no people living in North Philadelphia where I was that were white. The only time I saw Caucasians is when I saw them on TV and when I went down to Italian Market with my grandmother.
It was just a small black community.
Again, that's Diane Precht.
I thought it was like four blocks, but reality, I think it's like three blocks. It was like a lot of close-knit families.
Cheney's and Precht's families had spent time in North Philly, where they'd seen gang violence and other crime. Jewtown was considered safer, but the parents kept their kids close.
We really stayed inside our community because it was safer at the time. As a kid, we didn't realize that that's why we had to stay. We just was like, okay, whatever. And then as you got older, you realize, okay, we stay because it is safer to stay in your neighborhood.
Although under a tight watch, the kids lived a free-range lifestyle within those four blocks.
This was our world. It was just crazy, the kind of recreation that we would have to entertain ourselves with. We sometimes we would not go down to the slaughterhouse, you know, and sneak in there and ride pigs. There was no way in the world you could go in a house and your parent didn't know where you were. As a matter of fact, when you opened the door right away, they knew by the aroma.
Today, vacant buildings and empty lots pepper the landscape. Precht says everything changed when drugs became a problem. But she and Cheney say their success later in life is because they grew up here. Cheney worked as a social worker and drug counselor, and Precht owns her own hair salon.
We didn't have a lot, but we had each other, and I'm thinking about all the people that I grew up with, and it was amazing.
For WHYY, I'm Jessica Karkunis in 19134.
Today is National Dog Day. According to the American Veterinary Medical Association, more than 43 million U.S. households have a dog. So yes, Americans love their pets, but many will admit their dog's behavior can sometimes be a bit of a mystery. What are they saying when they lick things? Will they ever learn they're not going to catch that bird? Or that tail they're chasing is actually their own? The University of Pennsylvania School of Veterinary Medicine's been compiling a database of reported dog behavior. It's called CBARC, which stands for Canine Behavioral Assessment and Research Questionnaire. Joining me now is lead researcher James Serpell. He's a professor of ethics and animal welfare at Penn's Veterinary School, where he directs the Center for the Interaction of Animals and Society. Dr. Serpell, thank you for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
My pleasure.
What sort of behavioral issues is the survey screening for?
Pretty much everything we could think of. So it's quite an extensive questionnaire. It's about 100 questions, and they cover pretty much the gamut from the dog that, you know, tries to bite the postman or the mailman to the dog that becomes distraught when the owner leaves it at home alone to the dog that just does kind of slightly annoying things like incessantly chasing squirrels or whatever it is that the owner finds a bit frustrating at times.
What do you think the data is revealing about canine behavior?
Well, a surprising amount. A lot of people, when we started on this project, thought, well, you can't rely on any of this information because it comes from dog owners. But it turns out that dog owners are actually quite good citizen scientists. They're quite good at reporting what their dogs do, as long as you ask the question in the right sort of way. And we're learning an amazing amount about dog behavior from these types of surveys. So we now have, I think, something like 30,000 dogs in the database. And we're always looking for more because, you know, we're trying to do, for example, comparisons between different breeds. And for that, you need you know, a fair number of dogs of each breed. And we're, you know, we're now in this country, we have about somewhere between 300 and 400 different breeds. So when you start to divide it up, you finish up needing quite large numbers.
What do you intend the results to be used for?
Well, our original goal when we set out to do this was to understand the reasons why some dogs develop these sorts of behavior problems and why some dogs don't. And by understanding the reasons, maybe be able to do something about it, sort of reduce the numbers of dogs that develop these types of problems. Because, you know, sadly, a large number of dogs that develop these types of problems end up at an animal shelter, or they end up being taken to the veterinarian for euthanasia. And we feel, and I think a lot of people feel nowadays, that most of these problems can be solved if you understand what's causing them. So that was our goal, really, was to understand the causes of these behavioral problems. But actually, we welcome any dogs into the database, not just those that have problems. So we're interested in understanding just the sources of variation, if you like, in behavior among dogs in general.
And the database that you've put together, the CBARC database, is going to be available to people to compare and contrast what their dog's doing, right?
Right. It automatically will give you an evaluation of your dog in comparison to all the other dogs in the database. And if you've got a dog that belongs to a numerous breed, it'll do a breed comparison. So it'll tell you whether your German Shepherd is different or similar to other German Shepherds and in what ways. So it does give you that kind of quick comparison.
So how do people get involved?
They can go online. They can go to cbarq.org, cbarq.org, and they can just sign in, complete a very limited profile about themselves, and then start telling us about their dogs.
Dr. James Serpell, thank you for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Nice to join you.
James Serpell is a professor of ethics and animal welfare at Penn's Veterinary School, where he directs the Center for Interaction of Animals and Society. You can read more about the survey and learn how to participate at SciStarter.com. Summer is winding down, which means the start of the new theater season is just around the corner. One of Philadelphia's more established and respected theater companies is opening the season with a play whose title cannot be said on the radio. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports the Arden Theater's Gamble with Vulgarity.
After 28 years, the Arden Theater has established itself as a powerful professional company in Philadelphia, known for the quality of its productions and its robust programming for kids, including a popular theater summer camp. In the lobby of the Arden, with kids filing past, is a poster for an upcoming production. The poster says it's called Stupid Bird, with a big blank space between stupid and bird. But that's not the actual name of the play. The title, as it appears in the program, is something I can't say on the air. Let's call it Stupid F***ing Bird. It's an adaptation of Anton Chekhov's The Seagull. Playwright Aaron Posner started with that provocative title 4 years ago and wrote a script to match it.
I wrote this play going, I don't think anyone's going to come see it. And I'm not sure any theater will ever produce it. I actually sort of thought the Philadelphia Fringe Festival might be the place that I might be able to convince to produce it.
Instead, the play opened at the Woolly Mammoth Theater in Washington, D.C., and has gone on to become extraordinarily popular. Last season, it was one of the most produced plays in professional American theater.
Shock. Totally shocked and delighted. You know, it feels like something one would say in an interview, but it's totally true that I wrote it in the conviction that probably people wouldn't produce it, that the title alone would keep anything other than a handful of theaters in the country from even considering it.
And on we go. More books, more plays, more.
The wholly original script, which Posner is also directing, concerns the tumultuous loves and relationships of a family of artists struggling with the compulsion to create more art.
And the songs, my God, the songs alone. Sometimes I think we should have a moratorium on the creation of art for 100 years. Let's just take a good look at everything we already have, and then maybe we can decide what else we might need.
Posner was one of the original founders of the Arden Theater. He's since left for Washington, D.C. His co-founder, Terry Nolan, is the Arden's current artistic director, and he says Posner told him about this play title while he was writing it.
And I remember saying to him, oh, Aaron, that's not a good idea. Really? He said, yeah, I am. And I said, all right, well, that's hard. That's tricky.
Nolan has since come around to that provocative title. He says it's appropriate because it signals that this story is radical, irreverent, and contemporary, as long as you're okay with that kind of language.
We talked to other theaters who have done it, and Woolly Mammoth at first would refer to it as that stupid bird play. And we said, yeah, we want to call it stupid f-ing bird or stupid effing bird. So the people are aware that this is a radical new version. And if profanity bothers you or puts you off, this is probably not the best play for you.
Nolan says this play is the most popular of the Arden's upcoming season so far, according to advanced ticket sales. Also, so far, no complaints from patrons for either the regular or the children's programming. The show opens in mid-September. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Binyakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Our news director is Eugene Son. Our engineers this week were Al Banks and Diana Martinez. Sandra Clark is Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. You can listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm Tom McDonald for Newsworks Tonight.